I first want to thank Jackie Hodgson for inviting me today to speak about the effect of the struggle against terrorism on immigration and asylum rights. And my examples will come from Europe for the most part, or entirely. In any case, in fact, terrorism and migration and asylum have been linked at least since 1951, when the Refugee Convention excluded terrorists from the definition of refugee. The status of refugee cannot be given to anyone who is suspected of having committed a serious non-political crime outside the country of refuge. Now, all definitions of terrorism, which Thomas Weingent didn't get into, provide that terrorism is not a political crime. So terrorists do not benefit from the protections of the Refugee Convention. At the time, states were worried that asylum seekers might in fact be terrorists fleeing justice in their own countries. Today, we're more worried that asylum seekers or even migrants would be terrorists trying to get into our countries to commit acts of terrorism, which makes things a little bit scarier. The UK Home Office website shows up this close link between migration and terrorism by saying that controlling who passes through our country's borders is an essential part of protecting us from terrorism. However, when immigration or asylum law is used to combat terrorism, states can essentially convict people of terrorism without the niceties of criminal procedure. Immigration statutes often do not incorporate or refer to criminal statutes defining terrorism, and criminal due process rights do not apply to immigration or asylum proceedings. When preventing terrorism takes pride of place among immigration and asylum policy goals, migrants and refugees, particularly those from Muslim countries or countries having experienced armed political struggle, have a harder time gaining entry to and are more easily expelled from countries of immigration or refuge. In any case, the terrorism migration link may mean protracted administrative detention or return to home countries despite the dangers of persecution or even torture, with no or very little legal representation or contact with a judge. I'll first discuss the managed entry policy of the European Union, compounded by the struggle against terrorism since 2001, and give you a few examples in the areas of deportation and detention that pit refugee and immigrant rights versus the state's interest in preventing terrorism. In the 1970s, most states began restricting immigration, but the restrictions were not enough to stem the flow of asylum seekers and migrants, both legal and illegal, into what is now the European Union. So the Maastricht Treaty turned both immigration and asylum into what it called issues of common interest. And those issues are now the subject of common EU policies. Simply put, the immigration policy is to let in migrants who meet EU economic and demographic needs and keep out those who don't. And the asylum policy is to process and resettle refugees as close to their country of origin as possible. But in fact, there have been common rules and procedures since 1985 for a few countries and 1995 more generally with regard to the Schengen area. One such rule is that air carriers must verify the asylum claims of their passengers, and they face heavy fines if any of their passengers turn out to be what are called false refugees. When the common policy announced at Maastricht started taking shape at the Tampere summit in 1999, states expressed support for an open and secure European Union fully committed to the obligations of the Refugee Convention. However, at that time, they already admitted fewer than half as many refugees as they had in 1989. In 2004, the EU asylum policy became one of improving access to durable solutions. Now, this means developing a common European asylum system designed to provide refugees worldwide with effective protection and durable solutions as quickly as possible and as close to home and to their needs as possible. At that time, Statewatch described it as essentially involving the creation or expansion of refugee camps outside the European Union and likened it to the Blair government's proposal for externally processing refugees seeking entry into the UK. Since then, first asylum requests in the EU have dropped by 32% and in the UK by 31%. Now, that's down from already in 1999, fewer than half as many refugees in 1989. Security Council resolutions 1373 of 2001 and 1624 of 2005 encourage and reinforce these policies by implicitly assigning a higher priority to preventing terrorism than protecting refugees. Resolution 1373 was adopted shortly after September 11th. In addition to requiring states to combat the financing of terrorism, it requires them to deny safe haven to terrorists and to prevent the movement of terrorists or terrorist groups by effective border controls. In addition, before granting refugee status, states must ensure that the asylum seeker has not planned, facilitated, or participated in the commission of terrorist acts. Missing from Resolution 1373 are a definition of terrorism and any reference to human rights. Sir Jeremy Greenstock, the first chairman of the Counterterrorism Committee that was created by the resolution, said that making sure states meet their obligations under international human rights conventions is beyond the committee's mandate. Subsequent resolutions pay lip service to human rights obligations by reminding states of them, but only 1624 stands on equal footing with 1373 because they were both adopted under Chapter 7. But the language of 1624 indicates that protecting refugee and migrant rights is not on equal footing with preventing terrorism. It first reaffirms the imperative to combat terrorism by all means, then calls upon states to prohibit inciting terrorism, to refuse asylum to persons reasonably suspected of having done so, and to tighten their borders. It then stresses that states must comply with their human rights obligations, but there are no apparent consequences if they don't, because the Counterterrorism Committee is still not charged with monitoring compliance with human rights obligations. Thus, many measures that have been adopted since 2001 are designed to ensure that people suspected of terrorist links will not be considered for asylum, and that non-citizens who participate in or encourage terrorist acts are deported. For example, in the immediate aftermath of the July 2005 bombings in London, the Home Office adopted guidelines providing for the deportation of any non-Briton using any medium to foment, justify, or glorify terrorism. Turned out that three of the individuals responsible for the bombings were born and raised in Britain. So Parliament passed the Terrorism Act 2006, which applies to Britons as well. This act broadly defines the offenses of encouraging terrorism and disseminating terrorist publications. It also criminalizes something called trespassing, etc., on nuclear sites. Thus, disseminating pamphlets promoting anti-nuclear protests, such as those of the Women of Greenham Common, may fall within the act. If so, non-Britons may be deported for such activity, and persons engaging in similar activity in a country like Pakistan could be denied asylum. As you can see, to complement the heightened barriers to entry, states have relaxed deportation criteria. With regard to prohibiting incitement to terrorism, we might think that the UK, the Security Council, and the Council of Europe in its 2005 Terrorism Convention are simply following France's example. In France, public expression that directly provokes or justifies acts of terrorism has been a punishable offense since 1881. But in 2004, France decided this was insufficient protection against terrorism and turned incitement to discrimination, hatred, or violence against a specific person or group of persons into grounds for deportation. A 2006 report by the French Anti-Terrorism Unit indicates that 71 so-called Islamic fundamentalists have been deported since 2001, and 17 Islamic activists were deported in 2006 alone. Amnesty International has brought to light eased deportation standards in Spain and Italy as well, to avoid having to prove terrorist activity before deporting someone. Spain revived a 1985 law that allows for expedited deportation of any alien whose behavior is a threat to national security or who is implicated in activities contrary to public order. An individual subject to the expedited procedure has only 48 hours to contest the deportation order, and no procedural guarantees exist that would avoid deportation to torture in violation of the European Convention on Human Rights and the Torture Convention, both of which prohibit returning a person to a country where they may be subjected to torture or other inhumane treatment. Similarly, the Italian law on emergency measures to fight against international terrorism was passed at the end of July 2005, so after the London bombings. It provides that an administrative agent may order the deportation of any alien she has good reason to believe constitutes a threat to national security. Appeal does not suspend deportation, which is immediate. So again, the right not to be returned to torture is not sufficiently protected. To get around this last problem, as you probably know, the UK has concluded safe return agreements with countries such as Jordan and Algeria. Known as diplomatic assurances, countries basically pledge that deportees will not be tortured. As with many measures taken to prevent terrorism since 2001, the practice has already been judged contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights. In the 1990s, the UK wanted to deport a Sikh separatist who had already been beaten in jail in India. In Chahal versus UK, the Court of Human Rights held that states cannot rely on diplomatic assurances when a substantial risk exists that the person will suffer torture or other mistreatment. In 2001, the issue of neutralizing aliens suspected of terrorism who cannot be deported came up once again. And the UK opted for indefinite administrative detention under the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act. This was held to be unlawful by the House of Lords under the Human Rights Act 1998. But the indefinite detention in itself didn't seem to be the problem. It was the discrimination between citizens and non-citizens. So in the Prevention of Terrorism Act 2005, Parliament simply replaced the discriminatory detention provision with a system of control orders applicable to British citizens as well. Now, the detainees at the time of the decision were all held in detention until the new law was passed and then were released under these control orders, which amount to house arrest. They wear electronic bracelets. Their communications are monitored. They can't leave their houses for more than a certain amount of time per day, etc. In 2002, the Canadian Supreme Court took a much bolder approach. Just a few months after the September 11th attacks and Resolution 1373, the court held that the state's interest in protecting national security trumps its obligations under the Torture Convention. And they affirmed the deportation of a suspected terrorist to Sri Lanka, where there was a substantial risk that he would suffer torture. But even asylum seekers who are not suspected of terrorism or other crimes are caught in the conundrum of detention or release pending possible removal procedures. As Amnesty reported in 2005, detention of asylum seekers in conditions that violate numerous rights under international conventions has become commonplace. Amnesty estimates that in the UK, tens of thousands of asylum seekers have been subject to protracted, disproportionate detention solely under the Immigration Act. They're detained from the moment they arrive until the moment they're granted asylum or removed, the argument being, of course, that detention avoids removal problems. In Italy, asylum seekers are subject to violence by guards and group expulsions, which are prohibited by the European Convention on Human Rights. And in all three countries reported on, the UK, Italy, and Spain, detainees often live in unhygienic conditions, receive unsatisfactory medical care, have insufficient access to legal advice, and have trouble obtaining a fair and efficient determination of their asylum status. Detention under such circumstances may violate numerous detention-related rights protected by the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the rights to seek asylum and to be free from arbitrary detention protected by the European Convention and the Refugee Convention. Obviously, not all of these problems are strictly related to the struggle against terrorism, but they are compounded by that struggle and the emphasis given the prevention of terrorism. The Council of Europe recently spoke out about this disconnect between the struggle against terrorism and human rights, though in a different area. The Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe passed a resolution in January regarding the United Nations Security Council and European Union blacklists, that is, the asset freezing orders that are applied to persons suspected of financing terrorism and the no-fly lists. The Assembly finds that the procedural and substantive standards currently applied by the Security Council and the Council of the European Union in making these orders in no way fulfill minimum procedural standards and violate the fundamental principles of human rights and the rule of law. Now, the rights at issue are the protection of property as affected by asset freezing and personal liberty as affected by travel restrictions. One would hope that the Council of Europe will soon take similar note of the more severe restrictions on the right to personal liberty of asylum seekers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What is it? Yeah, I'm getting prize. Thank you.